We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Mobile phones, lightweight computers, social media, these things can all be great tools for keeping in touch. But have they taken the place of connecting face-to-face? This morning on our show, we'll be talking with a scholar who spent quite a lot of time thinking about, writing about people's relationships with technology, and particularly computers. Sherry Turkle is her name, and she's an expert on things like mobile technology, social networking, and sociable robotics. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in her most recent book. The title is Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, and it's published by Basic Books, and indeed does take a look at the potential of the kind of technologies that we're talking about now, this vast power to connect that we all can carry in our pocket now, the potential for those technologies to both unite and isolate. She also looks ahead to a future where machines might actually substitute for human contact. Sherry Turkle is professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology in the program in Science, Technology, and Society at MIT, and has written a number of books dealing with the people and their relationship with computers. And this is really a book that she sees as the third in a trilogy of books that deal with this technology. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. So people who are here locally where we are, use that number. Toll free, anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you certainly can do that. Our email address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. We certainly welcome people into the show. We hope people will keep their comments brief and on target with the topic, and that will make it possible for us to get in as many different people as possible. Professor Turkle, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
To start off, maybe I can ask you to talk a little bit about this tension, this paradox that I think that you're trying to get at with the title of the book. And talk a little bit about, yes, it's true that the sorts of things we're talking about, they do make it possible for people to connect and to communicate, but in some interesting ways, they can be very isolating.
Yeah, I mean it in a very practical sense. I mean, you go out to dinner and you're with your friends. I mean, you are with your friends, but everybody has a phone on the table, and, you know, at various points at dinner, people are gone. I mean, they're just gone. They take their calls and they disappear into their own worlds. I have a house on Cape Cod, a beautiful house where people walk the dunes that Thoreau walked, you know, dunes of beautiful, where people used to walk with friends and be together, and now people walk those dunes and they carry their, whether they're alone or with company, you know, they carry their devices and they, you know, they disappear into their devices. I went to Thanksgiving dinner and people came from all over the country to be together. And then after, you know, 1.5 courses, you know, people started texting. People text at funerals. People text in the playground where they push their kids with one hand on the swing and text with another. I mean, we all have our own examples. And I think that there's a sense in which we're losing a sense of, in our infatuation with what is possible with this technology, and so much is possible with this technology, where something is going amiss. We're losing our sense of presence at moments that matter.
The one I can't quite get over, you mentioned it, and I know that you mention it when you talk about it. It's people texting at funerals. That's
yes.
The one I can't quite. I just can't. Yes. I can't quite believe it.
Well, no. I mean, I have the qualitative methodologist rule that you don't put anything in your writing that you haven't seen many times, because then it's a one-off. You know, then nobody will recognize it as something that's really in the world. And it's actually quite common. I mean, it's It's something, it bespeaks our, people text during Shiva calls. I'm Jewish, and a Shiva call is something where when a parent dies, you stay in your home and you you receive people into your home who are coming to visit you, bring food, and essentially help you mourn. People now come to these calls and go into a corner and text. And this is not infrequent. So, I mean, I think it's a sense that people don't no longer even know anymore that this isn't something to do. I mean, I think we're also losing our sense, of what's appropriate and what's not. And when people say to me, oh, it's just a question of etiquette, I think that's not quite right either. I think we're losing our sense of presence. I think it's a little bit more than etiquette when families text during dinner. I mean, there is a sense of kind of what are the sacred spaces that we keep for ourselves. It's almost that I think that we're so busy communicating that we sometimes don't have time to think. We're so busy communicating that we don't have time to really connect with the people who matter. Well, and I think that's what we have to get right.
I think this is a very important point, because I think, as you say, that some people will look at this and say, it's just a problem of bad manners. But I think that what that does is it fails to acknowledge the seductive, and I'm not sure that that's really a good word, but the powerful hold these technologies can have. And to me, that begs the question, well, why? Why is it that we have such a hard time putting these things down and turning them off?
Well, that's what I'm trying, you know, that's what I've definitely have studied and that what Alone Together tries to address. And one of the things that I find when, for example, I interview mothers who, you know, they're driving 65, 70 miles an hour, they have three babies in the back seat, and they tell me that when they see the little red light go off on their BlackBerry, which is on the seat behind, you know, behind them in the front, they start texting and they can't not look at what the messages are. They know they're putting their lives and the lives of their children in danger, and they can't stop themselves from essentially, you know, emailing in the car. And they tell me that it's the place for hope in their life. It's the place where good things will come to them. It's the place where sweetness comes. So it's as though we have what psychologists would call a transference to these devices. There's a sense of, this is the place where we put our hopes, we put our dreams, we put our sense of connection and possibility. And to me, that speaks of that we don't have enough in our communities, we don't have enough in our relationships, we feel that other things have failed us. So that's why I don't want to talk too much about etiquette, because I think that there's something larger at stake. There's something larger that hasn't worked. And I think we need to address that, because all the social networks in the world are not going to put that back together again. We have to address that head on.
As I mentioned, this is you see this, and you explain that you see this book as being the third in a trilogy of books that you have been working on now over quite a number of years, the others being The Second Self and Life on the Screen. And that these were books that had to do with your interest in looking at and thinking about how computers and our relationship with them affect us as individuals, and how it is they affect our brains, and how it is it affects our sense of identity or the ability to take on other identities. And that these things were, your take on the technology in those books is generally positive and optimistic. I think anybody who didn't know that, though, might look at Alone Together and think that you were one of this growing number of people that is saying, wait a minute, maybe this is not such a good thing, and that maybe these technologies aren't as good as or as wonderful, as desirable as they might seem. And that's not exactly true.
Well, I think that my view is that these technologies are wondrous, but very seductive, and that with mobile connection, something has gone amiss, and it's time to make the corrections. And there was something that I missed in 1995 when I wrote Life on the Screen, which was my first book on mobile connection. It was a book about the early internet. And I'm, you know, I'm okay to say that there was something I missed. I tell my students, call me not prescient. I joke with them. And I think it's important when a researcher, you know, is honest and a researcher, you know, I work very long. My books take me about 10 years. They're qualitative methods. I interview and do field observations with hundreds of people. But something that in the technology changed, and I missed something, and here's what I missed, and here's what changed, is that in my early investigations of the Internet, where I was so excited about the identity experimentation on the Internet, the fact that you would have a chance to go online and experiment with identity and fall in and out of love with people and ideas, which I think is so important, both in adolescence and later in life, I imagined you at a computer experimenting with these things and then getting up from your desk and living your life. And then going back to your computer and experimenting with these things and then kind of having dinner with your family. And I imagined this as something that you would dip in and out of. And then in 1995, I met a group of researchers at MIT who called themselves the cyborgs, who essentially wore computers on their bodies, wore the Internet on their bodies. They had goggles that were glasses that had screens. They wore computers on their backs. They had little antennas that connected them to the Internet. They wore the web on their bodies. They were always online. But they didn't have any more than we all have now if we carry a BlackBerry or an iPhone. And I realized that that was the future, that we were going to be able to dip in and out of the Internet all the time, that we would be on the web all the time, that we could essentially bail out of wherever we were at any moment of difficulty or tension and go online, that we would be always on the web, that we'd be always on and always on us. And that's the life we live now, and that opens psychological possibilities where I think we've run into some trouble. And that's what I didn't see, and that's why my work, if you say it's gotten darker, I think it's become more cautionary, because that is the thing that's proven so seductive.
Well, and I think it's fair to make the point that what you're trying to do here is you're raising questions and you're trying to get people to think about it. And you're not necessarily saying that this is the worst, but you're saying, well, let's think about this.
Absolutely. I'm not saying unplug. I'm not, as a matter of fact, I'm absolutely saying not unplug. I think this technology is wondrous. It is our life partner. It's kind of like you need to go on a digital diet. It's like food. You're not going to do without food. You're going to find the most healthy relationship with food. And I think we haven't made the baby steps in trying to have the most healthy relationship with this technology. It is not the most healthy relationship with this technology to sit at a dinner table with your family with everybody texting. I can't be convinced. It's not the most healthy relationship with this technology to do, as many of the children in my study, tell me they do, to have your parents read you Harry Potter with their right hand and be doing their email scrolling through their BlackBerries with their left hand. You know, I mean, it's just we haven't been talking about this. We haven't been really thinking about this in a kind of systematic and reasonable way. I'm not the Grinch. I'm not taking anything, you know, I don't want to take anything good and happy away from anyone. But something has gone amiss, and I know something has gone amiss because the people who I interview are not, they're not content. I don't think it's a situation where half the world are happy campers and then there are these people who Sherry Turkle interviewed who are not, you know, happy with what's going on. I think a lot of us are getting wonderful things out of our technology, but we sort of realize that something has gone amiss in our relationships with the people around us, and we kind of want to make the corrections. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more like that.
One more point, and I promise I have some people who are on hold here. I'm going to get to callers. But to come back to something that that sort of touched me and tickled me, and I know that you talked about it being surprising when you went out to talk to people about their experiences of this technology, that you expected that you would meet a lot of parents who said something like, you know, I can't get my kids' attention because they're fooling around with their smartphones. Well, the fact is, what you found was there were a lot of children who were saying, I cannot get my parents' attention because they are fooling around with their smartphones.
Absolutely. And, you know, when a qualitative methodologist says she has a finding, that is really serious because, you know, that's not the language that qualitative methodologists, that's not the language that ethnographers use. But that was very dramatic. It's the parents who were smitten and the children who were saying, whoa, you know, my mom comes to pick me up at school. She's on that carpool line. I come out of school. I'm trying to make eye contact. She will not look up. Her eyes are down. She's doing her email. And I get in the car, and she still is kind of waving me away. Let me just finish this email. Let me just finish this email.
Our guest in this hour is Sherry Turkle. She is a scholar who's done a lot of writing and thinking about people's relationships with computers. She's an expert on mobile technology, social networking, and sociable robotics. She's on faculty at MIT, where she's professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology in the program in Science, Technology, and Society. She's also founder and current director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. And her new book, if you would like to read it, is Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, published by Basic Books. We have a couple of callers. We'd like to invite people into the conversation. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. First, we'll talk with somebody up in Cisna Park, line 4, the toll-free. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Great topic. There's a lot there. I'm calling actually on a cell phone in the hinterlands of Illinois, so I'll make it quick because I don't know if I'll lose you or not. But I just had a couple of quick observations and comments if your guests care to respond. A couple of things that happened to me now is very interesting, where you can actually go into a retail store and have somebody wait on you and have the clerk never get off the cell phone, never make contact with you. It's almost like we're all kind of turning into automatons. But I had an interesting thing happen. We have a friend who's 30 years old, and he has a cat. He's single. And he posts a picture of his cat on Facebook, and he comes in and he goes, oh, my goodness, a lady in California says she liked my cat. And I turn to my wife and I go, okay, we're crazy. Somebody's nuts. I think it's us. So I do agree completely with your guest that there's some sort of void out there, but people aren't relating to the people that they're with. They're relating to somebody over a device, and you can see this when you go into any big city or town. It's like you're walking among robots. It's very odd. I do think that part of it is a generational thing. We recently bought my mother-in-law, who's 78, a Kindle, because we said this is a new hot thing, and she goes, well, I want a book, and we're like, well, this is a book, and so anyway, I don't think we can put the toothpaste back in the tube. I think we're going to have to relate to this. But I certainly, being 55, don't really care for this to this extreme. But I think it's only going to get worse. And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Well, you can reflect on that.
I disagree. I mean, I love these examples, and I'm laughing, but I just want to disagree about, I wrote this book because I don't want to go along with it's just going to get worse. I mean, it's not technology's fault if we haven't pulled ourselves together to use it sensibly. I mean, we can have Kindles and books just the way, you know, everybody was jumping around saying, you know, it's the end of the magazine, it's the end of the magazine. Well, it turns out that, you know, a lot of people like magazines, and they also like iPads, and they like to have a physical magazine to touch and to keep around your house. And, you know, it turns out that we're creatures that like the sensuous in many forms, and I think that's wonderful. And I think that I see some hope in the younger generation because they grew up with parents who texted during dinner. And I see them kind of nostalgic for a life they didn't live. And I think that if enough people sort of get disgusted with walking in a city that where nobody seems to be able to make eye contact, so maybe some of us will say, in the first generation of having this available to us, we walk through our beautiful cities with our heads down. You know, what is that famous video that went viral, walking into fountains? And then, you know, in a next generation, we said, you know, our cities are beautiful, and it's nice to make eye contact with the people who live here. Let's unplug. I mean, my favorite line in my book, if an author is allowed to have a favorite line, I guess I am, is just because we grew up with the internet, we think the internet is all grown up. And it's not. There's still time to make the corrections. The way we live with this now is not the way we need to live with it. It's as though the first generation who had the telephone and had party lines said, well, you know, the telephone is great, but, you know, there's something about this party line thing that really annoys me so much. I think telephones are kind of, I don't like them so much. I mean, I think that we should see this as something in its infancy, and we're just starting to figure out how we want to use it. And from that perspective, I don't think the horse is out of the barn.
We'll go to another caller here. Lovington, line one. Hello.
Hi. Sounds to me like you're describing addiction in a lot of ways. My other comment would be the Amish down here, around here, they manage social stuff. You could argue about how successful they are doing it and stuff like that, but... I don't know. I can't figure out why every time we get technology, it's like it seems like it's almost would be wrong to even think about somehow managing it. I guess my last comment would be that I have five people in my family, and me and I'm the oldest, and my youngest kind of have about the same opinion of it. After 5 o'clock, we set it down, and unless we're expecting you to call us, we pretty much it's turned off. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, I'm particularly interested in your thought about the term addiction and whether that does or does not apply.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to people who use the term addiction because there are many reasons why it's a good term. I mean, we do get a squirt of neurochemicals every time we multitask, for example. Our brain rewards us for multitasking, even though our performance degrades with every task we multitask. And that's just kind of proven scientific fact. But we feel good when we multitask, so we want to do it more, and we think we're being masters of the universe, even though we're getting worse and worse at everything we do. It's tempting to use it, but I think it's the wrong metaphor, because if you're addicted, there's only one thing you can do. You have to stop using the thing you're addicted to. And we're not going to stop using technology. As I say, it's our life partner. And so people get hopeless when they think about addiction. And they say, okay, it's hopeless. And it's much more like an eating disorder. I like the phrase, I've come up with this phrase, digital diet. I mean, you don't give up food. You say, look, I'm vulnerable to sweets. I'm vulnerable to eating too much, and it feels good. It's sensuous. I have anxieties. It calms me. But, you know, I need to have a healthier relationship with food. And so how can I think about that? How can I eat food to nurture myself and to feel good, but to really have a healthier way of living with it? And that's what we have to do with digital technology. I just went to a fifth-grade reunion that was organized on Facebook for my PS216 in Brooklyn. Fifth grade. And that was fantastic. We met face-to-face. It was organized on Facebook. I mean, I don't want to have to give up Facebook. Look at what's happening politically with Facebook. I mean, all the wonderful things that this technology can do for us. I mean, you don't want to give this up. You want to say, what are the healthy things I can do with it? And one of the healthy things to do with it is not to alienate yourself from your family by not sharing a meal with them. So I'm very much against the use of the word addiction. I think it makes people feel hopeless. It gets them on the wrong path. And no matter how tempting it is, you know, not every metaphor, you know, we don't choose every, we don't go with every metaphor. And I just think it's the wrong metaphor.
Well, one other thing here, and this is kind of complicated. I don't know how well I can express it, but it's a concern that you raise that, and it goes back to this idea that part of the reasons that people can't have a hard time turning these technologies off is that they provide a certain gratification, perhaps at the biochemical level of what's going on in the brain.
Yeah.
And what you say is, you know, maybe something to be concerned about is going from, you know, the fact that we use these technologies and we get that satisfaction, going from that to using these technologies in order to get that satisfaction, that, you know, that is that it changes what's sort of the order in which we do these things. You know, we use them and we get the satisfaction from there to we want that satisfaction. And so we use them. I don't know how well I'm putting that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm making the same point. I mean, it's kind of like, so what? I mean, you know, it's like saying I can take heroin and get that satisfaction. You know, that's not a reason to take heroin.
Hmm.
It's bad for you. Or I can eat a lot of sugar and get a high, but then, you know, you get diabetes too. Or, you know, I mean, the cost you pay for taking your family dinner and turning it into a good time to text or do your email is a very high cost. It's too high to pay if we care about our families. The cost you pay for taking, you know, for taking the time. Well, I think about it. Let me take a simpler example. 15-year-olds go. So it's, everything isn't so dark. I mean, 15-year-olds go to a birthday party. And there's a point in a 15-year-old birthday party when everybody wants to go home because it's very hard to be 15 years old, and, you know, and really, you know, make it through a birthday party and, you know, and get to know all these new people, and there are boys and girls, and it's hard. But the point of a 15-year-old birthday party is you get through it. You know, you just get through it, and at the end of the party, everybody's done it, and you're closer to being 16 years old, and it's good, right? Well, now 15-year-olds go to a birthday party, and when that hard part happens, everybody goes on their Facebook, and essentially they leave the birthday party. They're gone. And that's not good. That's not good.
Well,
and you know, and saying, oh, well, you know, they've become addicted to their Facebook, I mean, who cares? It's not useful. They have to get over it. They have to develop other habits where they stay in the present. And the parents who are there have to laughingly say, have to put up a sign and put a little bit, you know, put a little, you know, give out the party favors and take away the phones as the kids come in. It has to be a joke. It just has to be how we learn to deal with this.
Well, one other point, and I think it's also an important point to make, that face-to-face communications with people can be kind of messy. They're difficult to control. You know, who knows what you come in, someone comes up, you start a conversation, who knows what they're going to say?
Absolutely.
And how you're going to, whether or not you're going to be able to extricate yourself at the point where you would like to. And that is why, apparently, so many people now say, like, you know, people have cell phones and they can talk, but increasingly not just kids but also adults would rather text than talk. And the reason is that it's a much more, you have a whole lot more control over the interaction that way than if you're actually talking to somebody, even if you're talking to somebody on the phone.
Absolutely. And this is both adults and children. And that's what that's one of the things we were talking about before, that I expected to find, you know, children, you know, teenagers driving their parents crazy, and it turns out that it's, you know, parents who are ignoring their kids as they, you know, parents who are ignoring their kids as much as teenagers who are driving their parents crazy with their phones. I mean, it's not. it's not in our interest to do that to each other. It just isn't in our interest to do that to each other.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Sherry Turkle. She's professor of the social studies of science and technology at MIT. She's written a lot about mobile technology, social networking, sociable robotics, people's relationships with technology, especially computers, and her most recent book. And if you're interested in exploring these ideas, things we're talking about here, you look for the book Alone Together. It's published by Basic Books. We do have some callers, some folks who were waiting patiently, and we'll get to them. First is Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you again. I wonder if your guest knows what the volume of cell phone use and the effects of it on the family in the third world.
Well, that's a really wonderful question. I don't have the statistics, but I certainly know that in the third world, the situation is somewhat different because there cell phones are, the connective tissue. The cell phones came before landlines. Cell phones came before laptops. I mean, cell phones are the connective tissue, and so their use is goes way beyond goes way beyond what they're doing to the family. They're the infrastructure for business. They're the infrastructure for bringing communities together. They're the infrastructure for politics. They're the economic drivers. So I think in the third world there's a somewhat different and more complex dynamic because so much more depends on them. But I really wouldn't want to comment on what they're doing to families. No, I wouldn't.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions?
But I do have an interesting piece of information that's not from my field work, but from talking to other anthropologists, that at meetings in the third world, where I'm sort of saying, well, look, in my faculty meetings or business meetings I go to, and board meetings, I mean, people are sitting there in meetings with their BlackBerries and they're texting. Apparently, in Africa, people sit at meetings and actually take calls. So I mean, there's a sense that every culture is making their own. But this isn't my field work. This is hearsay from other people's field work. But I mean, every culture is finding its own path. Every culture is finding its own path.
I wanted to make sure that we talk a little bit about another big issue that you deal with in the book. There are really two things, and they're different, but they're complementary, and we've talked about one of them. The other thing has to do with social robotics, this other interest of yours. And maybe the place to start is to tell me about your meeting with Cog.
Yes. Well, the way these two parts of the book fit together is really very is very important to me because, when you're on the network, you're trying to be intimate with people who are really there, but I'm arguing that you have a new solitude. And with a sociable robot, which is a robot that is a very special robot, it's a robot that's basically trying to say, I love you. It's not a robot that does your vacuuming. It's a robot that is designed to make you feel it cares about you. You have a kind of pretend intimacy, but really you're alone. So I met a robot like that again in 1995, and its name was Cog. And what was important about it is that I knew this robot knew nothing. It was just programmed to look at me, to track my motion, to recognize that I was a person because of my skin tone and because I had irregular motion, which is what people had, and it was programmed to kind of mimic my gestures. And I was visiting the lab where Rodney Brooks had developed this robot at MIT, a great roboticist at MIT, and I found myself competing with the other visitor for its attention and wanting it to sort of pay attention to me, even though I knew it knew from nothing. And I realized that this was a different kind of robot. This was a robot that whose seductiveness didn't depend on its being smart. It depended on its sociability. And I just, again, I just decided that this was something I wanted to study over 15 years. I really wanted to track where that was going, and I did. And it's ended up, I think, in a very complicated place where roboticists are designing nanny bots, you know, sociable robots that will take care of kids, teacher bots, and right now, elder care bots, particularly in Japan, where these are robots that will be out there to take care of the elderly in nursing homes and in particular, and be companions to them. And I have a problem with this because I brought robots like this into the United States and to experiment with them and see what I thought about them. And you know, it's not a happy picture for me to have an elderly woman trying to explain to a robot about a husband who died or a child she's lost in the Iraq War, to a robot that doesn't know what a life is, that doesn't know what a child is, that doesn't know what death is. I call it love's labor lost, that these are things that we deserve to have a person to talk to. These are things we owe each other. I think it's the human compact. And a robot that doesn't understand these things is not an appropriate entity to be talking to about these things.
And for people who are hearing this and who are thinking this is science fiction we're talking about, these are in fact technologies and products that are being developed, are being researched, and the idea is that indeed you could build a robotic companion caretaker for either the youngest or the oldest, and there are people who think we have two ready, enormous potential markets for these kinds of products in our children and our seniors. So we're not talking about science fiction here.
No, not at all. We're not talking about science fiction here. As a matter of fact, I think this is kind of perceived as a growth industry in robotics because, for several reasons. First of all, I think that people feel that we don't have enough people for these jobs. That's the first thing that roboticists say when they present these robots, that there are not enough people in these industries. We've not enough people in elder care, that we're running out of money in these industries, that the population is aging, and in some way that we've failed each other in these jobs, in elder care and in younger care and teaching, and that somehow robots are like the cavalry. It's like, we sometimes look to technology as though we're calling in the cavalry, as though it's going to solve problems that we failed each other about. And I guess I want to say that about this, and this is coming from an MIT professor, so I say I say this with all my heart. I think that sometimes technology makes us forget what we know about life. It's so seductive, it's so shiny, it's so bright, it seems so simple, and life is so complicated. And, really, why would you want to talk to a robot that has no concept of what a child is about your life with your child, about the death of a child, about your experiences with a child? This is not what we owe each other. This is not what we should be thinking about. And I feel very strongly about this, but everybody doesn't have to have my opinion. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm the kind of person where I didn't write this book so everybody would have my opinion. I wrote Alone Together so that people would start to talk about this, because this is coming, and I want people talking about this. I don't want this to take us by surprise. I don't want all of a sudden these robots to be here and people saying, bring them on. I want people to talk about this first. And so I hope this book be part of that conversation. I'm delighted to be talking about it because I want this book to be part of this conversation.
Yeah. Just one further point on that, because I would expect that there would be people who would argue, yes, on one level, the idea of someone having to turn to a robot for companionship is very troubling and maybe downright creepy. They might make the argument that, if you have no one else to talk to, if there is no other possibility for companionship, maybe that's not completely a bad thing.
Well, you know, I have a couple of points to make about this. In my experience, when we bring in technology in situations of companionship, we start to stop looking for people. So, for example, I have a 19-year-old daughter who brings dogs to nursing homes and cat, you know, and this kind of like pet therapy. But, you know, quite frankly, I think that this pet therapy thing, you know, the dog that she brings to the nursing home comes attached to my loving and charming 19-year-old daughter. So sometimes when she talks about the pet therapy, it's very unclear if it's pet therapy or if it's my daughter who, in fact, is providing the company. But, it, you know, essentially, there is, you know, this program that she, you know, she's in college and she's part of this program for pet therapy. But this takes organization. You know, this takes a group of college students, you know, making arrangements with the nursing home and training students to visit the nursing home and getting kids excited and telling them why it's important. And, you know, it takes work and energy and a kind of political organization and a kind of, I mean, I say political organization, and, you know, in the sense that you, you know, a kind of rabble-rousing among friends and networking. And, you know, it takes work and commitment and a little bit of money and milk and cookies. And, you know, it takes energy and time. Whereas, you know, buying a robot, that takes pressing a button and a credit card. And I think that we, when we can just press a button and buy something, we sometimes don't do the harder work of organizing ourselves as individuals, and we too often go to the technological solution. And I'm saying that I'm not so ready to say that there are no people for these jobs. This excuse that there are no people for these jobs, that there's no one else, doesn't make sense to me, given the unemployment rate, you know, given how many people are in fact mobilizable with an appropriate political will and sense of social will and purpose to in fact do the job of people taking care of each other. And I think that what technology sometimes does is give us an excuse not to take care of each other. And I think I'm trying to draw attention to that.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this hour of focus with Sherry Turkle from MIT. She's a scholar who's written a lot about people's relationships with technology, especially computers. And we have a couple of other callers. We'll try to get them both, starting with Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hi. Just three quick points. One is that, as far as I'm concerned, the takeaway is living in the present. We've had problems with that before technology to a certain degree in terms of, you know, we're thinking about, you know, when we graduate, we think about, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, we sort of wish our life away. We're going to do this and that. The second one is that what it says about society that, what is it, whether the program that you can do, a second life or whatever, I'm not sure if that's the terminology. I'm not on that one. And the third is that whether you want to comment on, in marketing they have what they call the 80-20 principle, which says that 80% of the people buy, let's see, wait a minute. No, 20% of the people buy about 80% of the products. You know, in other words, they have the users. So also in your study, looking at these different ones all the way from heavy users to whatever. And so I'll just, you know, you can pick or match, whatever. So great program.
All right, thanks. There's a lot there. We can't do all of that, but one point in there that you think is particularly interesting?
Oh, I'm just so pleased. I mean, I think that what gratifies me is the notion of necessary conversations. I think that's the tone that I want. That's the the point that I want to end on. That's my really my future work is that we've closed down what I think of as necessary conversations about this technology, because we've become infatuated. And I think one of the necessary conversations that this caller has so generously, you know, pointed to is about living in the present and about being present in intimacy and solitude. I mean, one of the great truths in psychology is if you don't teach your children how to be alone, they'll only be lonely. And we need to both learn how to be together, but we also need to learn how to be alone so that we can tolerate having the restorative things that come from just, you know, taking a walk in nature and city. And it was a very generous caller, and I appreciate his comment.
Well, this, I think, gets in another important point that you've pointed to, and I think other psychologists are starting to look at increasingly when you ask the question, what are the effect of these kind of technologies on our brain? And that is the issue that our brains need rest, and I'm not just talking about what happens when we're asleep.
Yeah.
And if opportunities for being quiet while you're conscious, if you fill every one of those opportunities with something that you're doing on a handheld device, that not only may that not be good for your social relationships, but it probably is not very good for your brain, for incorporating things you might have learned, for engaging in some kind of creative activity. But there are concerns about filling every waking moment with texting and being on the internet.
Absolutely. Our brains need rest, you know, physiologically and cognitively. And as Eric Erickson said about adolescence, but he could have said it about every point in the life cycle, people need stillness. Stillness is an important part of what people need to function interpersonally. And there's not enough stillness.
One more caller here, line two, Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question. I realize that you need to know about what the child is like if you're giving her a present that I bought for a great niece, 13 years old. A small dictionary of texting terms and a pair of gloves that have the fingers cut out so she could text outside. I thought, what a clever, funny gift. A teenager would love this. It would be a lot of fun. But I'm thinking now that I really better think about it a little more. Is this really going to be good for this child? Don't you agree that it's not something you would casually give to a teenager?
Oh, I think you should give it. I think that teenagers are going to text, and I think actually I would give it, and then loving, because you're now on her side and you know she's going to text, puts you in a better position to have a loving and friendly conversation about putting texting in its place. I mean, like I'm saying, is the point is to live with this in a healthy way. It's like giving a delicious chocolate to somebody. You're saying, you know, the point is never to never again have a Godiva chocolate. The point is to not, you know, it's not five Hershey bars a day. It's not, you know, M&Ms every morning, noon and night. You know, I mean, I would not give the gift. I would give it and then have a fun conversation about no texting during meals, that you want her texting her friends, you know, at fun, nice times, but never, never at dinner with you. Hmm. So I think that could be a fun present.
Just a minute or two left. I'm thinking about an earlier caller raised the issue of the Amish. And the thing that I think is worth saying about the Amish, people think that they're anti-technology. Well, that's not really true. The issue is that when they look at it, potentially introducing a new technology in their lives, they say, okay, here are our values, and here's this piece of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in harmony with our values? And if they can say that, they'd say, okay.
Yeah.
So the thing is that before doing anything, there's deliberation.
Yeah.
And it seems that probably most of the rest of us, we're much too, you know, we're way too early in our adopting things. We grab onto the shiny new thing first, and then only later do we start thinking about, well, what are the implications of this thing?
Yeah, you know, there's a wonderful The formulation that I have, you know, is kind of that, you know, every technology offers us an opportunity to think about our human values, and that's a good thing because we get to think about what they are. And that's really how I feel about this technology. It's an opportunity to say, okay, you know, what are our priorities? You know, what are our sacred spaces? When do we need to just be with each other? And I think we do have an opportunity here, and I think we should take it.
And to go back to your favorite line of the book, which is wonderful, you mentioned it earlier in the program, that you'd say just because we all grew up with the Internet, we think the Internet is all grown up. Well,
that's right.
In fact, you know, you don't have to think back too many years when there wasn't any Internet. And if you wanted to be on the net 24 hours a day, you had to be a cyborg. Well,
that's right.
You know, now, yeah, you can put it in your pocket, but that... It's not a fait accompli at this point. We can still think about how it is we want this technology to develop and what sort of place in our lives we want it to have.
Amen.
Oh, there, I blathered on there. I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time, because I think that there are plenty of good things to think about in the book, and that it's not just a one-sided sort of condemnation of the technology. It is, as you said, it's you're saying, look, let's think about this a little bit. Yes, there's potential for good, but, you know, there are also some downsides, and let's try to balance them out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Sherry Turkle, our guest, she is professor of the social studies of science and technology in the program of science, technology, and society at MIT. She's also founder and current director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. And if you would like to read her most recent book, the title is Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, published by Basic Books.